people always would always ask, are you in a major? Are you in a major? And I go, no, I'm not in a major. and people would go, oh, okay, that's cool. And now it's different. People go, are you signed? And I go, no, I'm in a profit share with an investor. And they go, wow, that's cool.
This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com.
Cool.
Welcome to the New Music Business Podcast. I am your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business. Today, my guest is Ali X. She is a Canadian artist, singer, songwriter that has been living in LA the last few years. She's back in Canada right now because of the quarantine and all of that fun stuff. She is a incredibly talented artist. She has over 100 million total streams. She has nearly 1.5 million monthly listeners on Spotify. She was supposed to go on a massive worldwide tour this past spring. Obviously, that was canceled, just like every other tour in the world. And so we kind of talk about what her journey has been like the last few months and how she has shifted all of her plans and the release strategies and all of that. But then we go into kind of her background and how she became Ali X and as an independent artist, how she became so successful doing this all independently without the support of a major label or really any label. She has a very interesting story and very interesting way of doing things. And I think you're really going to get a lot out of her talk. She was very candid. She had said she'd never really done an interview like this before where she dug into the nuts and bolts of everything. But I know that's what you want to hear. That's what I want to hear. And that's what's most interesting to me. So we went deep into that. As always, please like, subscribe, follow this podcast. However you're listening to this right now, please do that. It really helps. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. And visit ariestake.com to sign up for the email list. We let you know every time we release a new podcast episode and the current news of the industry and all the research and findings that I'm doing behind the scenes. Follow us both on Instagram. I am at Ari Herstand. She is at Ali X. You can find us also on Twitter. And you can follow the company both on Instagram or Twitter. It's at Ari's Take. All right, let's kick into the show. Ali X, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. We're writing a song right now. That was very, we worked out some pentameter there. That was good. where are you coming to me from right now? Where are you based?
My homeland. I'm back in Canada near Toronto.
Okay. And yeah. You were living in LA. Have you been living in LA or?
Yeah. I've been there for some time now. And that's where I spend most of my time. But I think like everyone, I was kind of like, why am I even in a metropolitan city right now when I can't so it was quite a process getting here though, because I wanted to bring my dog. And so, and she's really scared of flying. So we drove the whole way.
Oh my.
All across America.
Oh wow! When did you make the drive?
We got here just over 2 weeks ago because we just finished our 14-day mandatory quarantine. So yeah, that was like 2 weeks ago.
Ah,
yeah,
so they have that for driving too, then.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, we were really nervous crossing the border. Like they're quite strict.
Yeah, I mean, most of Europe is pretty much shut down travel from the States. Yeah. So that's nice that Canada let you back in.
Yeah, it's nice they let me back in.
I guess you're a citizen, so that kind of helps in your favor.
It does, yes.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So you've been spending the last few months in LA just kind of in quarantine.
Yeah, and I mean, I hadn't been in one place or at home in LA for longer than, I think, maybe 3 weeks for the last couple of years before that. Wow. Just like constantly going somewhere.
Yeah.
So it was good in a way. But then I just, you know, when you're just in one place too long, it gets kind of stale. Musically, I haven't been very inspired, and I thought maybe a change of environment would be good.
Yeah.
And it has been, so yeah.
Good. So you just released Super Duper Party People Remixes. Congrats on that coming out. Was that always the plan for to put it out now, or has just everything shifted?
No, everything shifted.
Right.
I mean, the plan for Cape God was to really, you know, really go for it in terms of
your latest album that you released in February, Cape God.
Yes, thank you.
Yes,
for the background there. Yes, the plan for Cape God was to do the most intense year of promo, touring, everything. And 2 weeks after it was released, everything basically shut down.
I saw you had a huge tour set up for that. It was a full North American. Then you were going to, I saw some dates in Europe you had.
Yeah, a bunch of dates in Europe too.
And I mean, it was like your tour, did you do any of the dates? Because I saw like the first date was end of March or mid-March or something like that,
right?
No,
we were in rehearsals and every day of rehearsal, things just got bleaker in terms of like, okay, every artist was canceling, and I was like, there's no way, like, it's just not even responsible anymore at that point.
Right.
So then we were going to try to do this digital concert, and one of the musicians was coughing the night before, so we called that off as well because we just didn't want to take any risks.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I, like everyone else, was sort of like scrambling, I think, in terms of how do I act online? What do I do now? What do I... And, you know, I started like learning some new skills, like video editing. And then ultimately I actually went, no. I actually really need a break, like a legitimate break. Like I haven't had a long break in so long. And so then I just kind of stopped posting, stopped writing music, stopped talking to everyone, hung out with my dog, walked every day, and started like learning how to DIY my condo.
There you go.
Yeah.
Nice.
That was kind of, so that was like 3 months of my quarantine. And now I'm here and I'm in like a new, now I'm all like creative again. So.
Right. That's great. I mean, it's interesting seeing that everything that people have seemed to put on the back burner for years, this is like the time to like put it to the front. It's like, well, everything else is canceled, so I might as well redo the deck that I've been planning on.
I might as well like finish my apartment that I thought was going to take years to get. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, amazing. So how was that for you at the start? Did you feel a lot of pressure to instantly switch from the, because you were mentally and emotionally, I would imagine, preparing for a tour?
I was full throttle. Like I released the record leading up to that. I think same thing, like the holidays happened, 2020 started, and I was in a different city every week leading up to the release. Release happened, I went out to Paris for Fashion Week, did these like a few promo things around Europe, came back, and yeah, it really felt like I was like going, like to slow down the whole, and then so many emotions came with that, and I think ultimately, I personally am going to look back on this as a time that I value. I've had a lot of, I think I've had a lot of important insight by stopping into my business, things like accounting. Like I've had time to like look at them and be like, oh, that's a mess. Like we need to fix that.
Yeah.
Or emotionally just sort of being like, whoa, girl, like you've got a lot of, baggage there that you haven't dealt with because you've just been working so hard, you've sort of distracted yourself, so you're gonna have to deal with that. Or like realizing that some things that I was doing don't even make me happy. Like there's so much that comes with just having like time and space, you know what I mean? And it's been, some of it's been difficult, but it's been really valuable.
Nice. I mean, that's great. It's been interesting talking to artists and other people in the industry on how they've been handling the shutdown and the quarantine and just having to refocus their energies and efforts so drastically. And I mean, it's great that you're learning new skills, that you're, you know, diving into projects that can still feel inspiring in some way. Mm-hmm. So I guess, have you just like pretty much stopped making plans or planning for the future or anything? Or do you have stuff that you're working on? Have you started up work again?
In some ways, I feel like I'm really organized because I have a handle on everything. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can relate to this, but I feel like in the music industry, we're always working kind of like 4 months ahead. You're paying for things 4 months ahead sometimes. Yeah. You have to advance whatever, and you have to put these down payments just to go ahead with the tour or whatever. And like, it can become a real mess because no one's ever dealing with the little issues at hand. They're working on the bigger picture things. And so in some ways, I feel like work-wise, actually, I feel really good because I can see everything and I have visibility on everything and I'm able to organize it all. And I'm even able to like plan a year ahead with what I've got right now, which is not what I had 6 months ago. Mm. But what I've got is enough for me to live on. And so I'm kind of just, I guess, taking everything that I can work with, mm-hmm. which is still substantial. I'm lucky. Mm-hmm. And just trying to, I don't know, I don't want to sound like nerdy or annoying, but optimize it or, you know, like I'm just sort of like, so in a way it feels like I'm like work-wise, I'm really good.
Yeah.
Whereas before I feel like I was flailing around and just saying yes to everything.
Sure.
So I don't know. And it's going to be interesting when things get back to normal, if that ever happens. I don't even know exactly how I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Do you, what's your team look like? What, who all is kind of part of the Alix team?
There's a lot of people on my team. I'm with Full Stop. They're my management. And then WME are my agents.
Okay. And when you say you're with Full Stop, do you have a singular manager person there, or is it kind of the full company that's, you have various people you work with?
Yeah, I used to work with Danny Russin and Brandon Creed, and now I'm working with Evan Winokur and Zach Phillips.
Gotcha.
Full Stop's been great.
How long have you been with them?
Let's see. I moved over there 2017. Three years.
Cool.
I didn't have great management experiences before that. So that was really nice when I finally found some management that were good.
Sure.
WME I've been with my whole, Alix journey. Mark mm-hmm. Geiger was always my guy, my champion at WME.
Sure.
He's leaving, as everyone knows. Everyone, like all his assistants, have always been amazing as well. So cool. I've been very happy with WME. And, you know, business manager, Myman Greenspan Legal. Mm-hmm. Then my label. I mean, this is probably like the most non-traditional part of my whole business, is that I have a profit share agreement with an investor. That's my label. Oh. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. I want to talk about that. How did that happen, and when did that happen, and what does it look like? And share as much of the behind the scenes as you can.
It's a crazy story. Yeah. And I hope that, I mean, I've never done a talk like this publicly. So, I hope I don't say anything that I'm not supposed to.
You can review the contract afterwards and we'll bleep it out or something if we need to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I work with a guy named Nick Gatfield, and he's based in London in the UK. When I first put out my very first song, Catch, I had that overnight everyone's interested thing. Hmm. After trying for 10 years to get it, I finally so everyone was calling all the majors, and Nick Gatfield was actually, but he was the first one. He was the head of Sony UK.
Okay.
And he was at Sony UK, and he wanted to talk on the phone. He's like, "We're flying you out next week. I love your demos. I love your thing. I think you have so much potential, blah, blah, blah. I want to sign you." And so, like, I got that really nice treatment and, like, taken to all the nice dinners and the nice mm-hmm. meetings, put in some good sessions. And I really liked Nick. I was like, this, like, so many executives are just total douchebags, right? And you sure. don't, and as a woman, you don't feel comfortable a lot of the time. Nick was a gentleman. He was really funny. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this guy's cool. Like, I've got a really good feeling about him. So I fly back to LA with kind of the intention of, like, he sounds good. Let's go. I was so green. I was like, let's do it. So I go and I Google him when I get back to LA. This is a day after I got back, and it says Nick Gatfield fired as head of Sony UK.
No.
Yeah, and which I learned is a totally is something that happens
very common.
All the time.
Oh yeah, you can't fall in love with people at labels because no. you don't sign with people, you sign with the companies, and it's in black and white.
Yeah. And so that's sort of like the first part of that story. And then the second part is after that, I met with a whole bunch of other labels, and I just had this really, I had like crazy hot-headed management at the time. And I don't want to name names or get into any of that, but basically sure. lots of things went down, and where deals had been fully on the table and they were ready to compete with each other, they were gone 3 months later.
Wow.
So I was left with no options.
Keep going.
Okay, yeah, I'll just finish this. So, Nick, please. So when I saw that Nick had been let go from Sony UK, I actually yeah. emailed him that week, and I said, "Please stay in touch. I think you're so cool, and I'd love to stay in touch." Basically, I really uh-huh. hit it off with you, and so he and I stayed in touch, and he ended up starting his own artist incubator called Twin Music. But even before that, like, he was always like, I had so much drama that went down after that period when everything fell apart and I was left penniless and with no help and nowhere to live and all these things, no cell, like my cell phone got cut off, all this crazy shit. And I had all these industry questions, and Nick was always there to just advise me as an experienced friend. Like, he without asking for anything. And so we kind of had that kind of relationship for at least a year and a half, 2 years. Then he started Twin, and I was the fledgling artist there. And we just, we've worked together ever since with really a great working relationship. We argue over creative differences, but we have respect for each other. He awesome. Lets me always see my vision through.
Cool.
And I feel like a business partner. So nice. I'm actually very happy that things went down the way they did.
So where did the funding come from for Twin Music? Is that this investor? Is Nick the investor? And is that
Nick's
the profit
investor.
Share that you have? Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, he's, you should interview him because he's got a lot of,
sure.
a lot of, he worked with like Radiohead and Amy Winehouse and mm-hmm. all these amazing people throughout his career.
Cool.
And he ended up, after being the head of I forget the other labels were, what was the one that started with Poly something that's not around anymore? Polygram?
Polyphone or something like that.
Yeah, I don't want to give yeah. misinformation, but he's been like the boss everywhere, and he just sort of stopped believing in the major label system and
sure.
and I think he has his hands in like some technology and stuff as well. Like he kind of like diversified himself, and
yeah.
I'm not sure what where the money comes from exactly, but
sure. So that's break down what that means when you're saying like profit share and investor and that kind of stuff is like
what
is,
it means.
Yeah.
What it means is that I still own 50% of my recordings, and we share the profit. And and they act as a label essentially. Like we work with AWOL,
yep.
and
distribution.
They'll act as a label in terms of like, you know, ingestion and pitching and
right.
making sure that the artwork's whatever. There's a person there who helps me with socials, who like content creation,
sure.
that sort of thing. On the creative side, I do most of it.
Yeah,
and I have my own people that I work mm-hmm. with. But they provide the basic label services, Nick brings to the table a lot of experience, a lot of a great ear. He was actually in this band called Dexy's Midnight Runners, and they did this, what's that famous song?
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah. Right. Come on, Eileen.
Come on, Eileen. Eileen. Yeah. So he's a musician, which is cool, too. So, cool. You know, he'll really care about the mix and everything, and that's always been cool. But, yeah, I don't know. I ended up in this situation where I, an incredibly controlling, anal, and, like, yeah, to a fault where I annoy people kind of person, ended up with a business partner who sort of... He's very patient. He's very kind and calm. And like, we just work really well together. And I almost feel like if I'd signed to one of those big deals that was on the table back in those days, I feel like I would have been dropped by now.
Mm,
and
sure.
Maybe had a bad taste in my mouth, you know, with whoever. Or yeah. maybe not. But it's been such a development for me. Mm. I've never had a record or a song that was like, you know, like, yeah. So, and that's what they're all looking for.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when you say profit share, and so you own 50% of your music, are you sharing in the revenue of everything, of tours, merch, everything?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. And then
actually, I think I own 100% of merch. They have a piece of physical music.
Got
like
it.
Vinyl or whatever, but I think any apparel or whatever, I think that's all mine.
And for tours, are they sharing in that revenue as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, but you also have to consider that, you know, to do a big tour for me, we're barely ever profiting. We're usually just breaking even. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm curious, and I'm everyone who's listening to this is probably wondering when you're like, the first song I released exploded and everybody, I was taking all these label meetings. Now, granted, you were an artist under the name Allie Hughes for what, 10 years or something? A while.
Yeah.
And then, like, take me from that point to how you came up with Allie X to this first song, quote, like, exploding and then every label having these offers on the table. Because that's not, yeah.
I mean, I'll say about my explosive song, Catch, it didn't explode in data, which is often, nowadays, actually, I think it's more important than it was, that was 6 years ago, I think.
Okay.
And, 6 years ago. It was more hype. It was the fact that Katy Perry had tweeted about it, and that Neon Gold, who were a really important blog at the time, had posted it, and that...
Sure.
All this press had picked it up.
Got
so it. That was kind of what it was. It wasn't like I had, it was like millions of streams on its first week, like viral, right. Like it wasn't viral, which is really what a lot of labels look for nowadays. But yeah, to get to that point, I mean, I almost want to cry and laugh at the same time because it was just, it was such a long journey. And then following that, it's been a really long journey as well.
Yeah.
So I started writing music kind of late, like after college, and I'd done like classical and musical theater till then, which now I regret. I wish I just like learned how to do GarageBand and spent all my time doing that as a teenager.
Sure.
But I was doing like Bach and like Grieg and like, and then like Sondheim. So it took me a while to actually get to the writing. And when I got to the writing, it was like Girl at a Piano, who sounded like she went to musical theater school.
Sure, right.
So it took me years to find my style. It took me years to find my sound. The turning point was really when I started to produce myself, when I learned Ableton. That was huge because I could work as much as I wanted. In Canada, in Toronto, it's very different in sessions. You're usually paying for studio time, and I had no money. So I was always limited on how much time I could spend in the studio.
Sure.
So when I started to produce, everything just kind of, even if my demos sounded like lo-fi and shitty, like you got the idea. You had the MIDI programmed for the cool bass line. You had the drum pattern that I wanted. Then you could just make it sound better.
Cool.
And that was when the Allie X sound kind of started to emerge. That's when I wrote Catch, this song called Tongue Tied that leaked but never came out, and this song called Prime. And I mean, Catch has, like, if I go into my old iTunes, I have like 20 versions of it. Like, some are have yeah. a swung beat, some don't. I tried yeah. singing it all these other different ways, all these different productions, and finally, I working with these other two producers, we landed on the sound.
Okay.
And they took my demos for Prime and Tongue Tied and just made them sound better. And that was when I felt that I had like the, that's when I felt like I had what I needed to even go to LA, because to get anywhere, you need to have the songs already.
Yeah.
Or at least that's kind of how I felt. Mm-hmm. Or you need to have a lot of money so you can just cover your cost of living for two years as you develop your catalog, I didn't. So I was able to finagle my way into a publishing deal. And they only saw me as a writer at that time.
How do you finagle your way into a publishing deal? Everyone wants to know. They come to LA. That's the dream. You come to LA and the next day I got a pub deal. How does that happen?
It was chance. And it was, in some ways, it wasn't a great deal to sign. But it was... it was what I needed to get my foot in the door, and it was what I needed to get in with immediately with the right crowd, which was, at the time, it was all the Prescription Songs people.
Okay.
So I ended up signing...
Did you meet any of those people beforehand?
Yeah. No, I mean, okay, so this is what happened. I was in Toronto still, and I was just at that point where I was finding like the sound that I was just talking about that ended up being the Alix sound. And at the same time, I was doing a residency at the Canadian Film Center as a resident songwriter / composer, which was cool. It was like I was getting like a grant to be there. And so I kind of convinced them that they should take us to LA on a trip to like meet other composers. Cool. But while I was there, I was like, is it cool if you guys like, because I didn't have $500 to fly to LA. Like, I was broke. And while I was there, I was like, is it cool if you guys switch my return ticket to a week later? And I stayed on my friend's couch and just, without knowing what the fuck I was doing, just sent a zillion emails to anyone that I could think, like a Canadian that knew somebody that knew somebody that lived in LA, kind of a thing. On the most part, nobody wrote me back, or they write me back and say, oh, I'm not available this week. There was this one company called Dream Machine, and they're a publishing company that had been founded under Circuit's a producer, and he's Canadian. I knew somebody who knew somebody. I took a meeting, and they were just like really, I don't know, they were young and excited, and in a way their inexperience is why they signed me, I think, or why they took a chance on me. And I was persistent. I mean, I still am. I'm really like, I'm not like a salesman, but I will keep emailing you. And like, I've always kind of been like that. And so that, it was, I guess, a combination of that. And then, you know, they got lucky because I'm actually good. Like, and I just needed someone to give me a shot.
Sure.
And once I was in those rooms, producers were like, oh, wow, you're good. Like, and we were making cool, I was making cool demos right away. Mm. But yeah, like they were only really seeing me as a songwriter, and it was like kind of 6 months into me moving to LA, they started to understand that they started to see me as an artist, which I secretly knew that I was, but I was like scared to, I just wanted to be like, okay, you're signing me. Like it's good. Get me my visa. And like,
right.
And like, I didn't even have a bed, but I was like, just let me have this room where I'm sleeping on the floor. And
that's amazing. No, I love that. Yeah. And that's the thing. The key to the industry is polite persistence. And it's great to hear. I mean, I love hearing the behind the scenes story of how the things happen, because oftentimes we don't, you know, like, you've struggled, you've been through it all, and like artists are out there trying to figure out how to do it and not understanding necessarily what it takes. And like, a pub deal didn't just show up. Like, you worked for it, you worked every possible connection that you had, anyone who knew anyone, like you said, and then
it
you
was
kept
ridiculous.
Going
yeah.
That's fantastic. No, that's great. That's what it takes. And that's like,
do you know Nasri?
No.
He's a producer. He's done like a lot of pop with like Justin Bieber and stuff. And I knew someone who was signed to him, and he would not, his brother was managing him, and he would not get back to me. So I just drove to his office and showed up. And I was like, we talked about having a meeting, right? And then, and he was like, all right.
Like, no shit.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And he was not into what I was. I only had shitty demos at that time. So he did not get what I was. But yeah, like that's what I was like.
Good
I was
for
like,
you. Okay.
I was like, this is, I'm in LA. Just being a Canadian and getting to LA is a challenge.
Sure, yes.
Especially if you don't have any money. But on the visa side as well, it's not like I could just stay there. Like, I had my week. I was like, I need to get something done. Mm. And I did.
Good for you. Real quick, I want to let you know about Too Lost. Too Lost is a new distribution company to the space. And let me tell you, I am very impressed with them. I got a full deep dive demo with the founder, and yeah, they're very innovative. And when you come into the distribution space at this stage with how crowded it is, you better be innovative, and they are. Yes, they will get your music out to Spotify, Apple Music, all the places, plus 450 other outlets around the world. They do not take a commission. This is why 300,000 artists and labels have already used them. They've already distributed 7 million songs. They offer payment splitting, and they don't charge your collaborators for this service for the payment splitting. They will just pay your collaborators directly for free. They have publishing administration with BMG, so you know it's legit. A lot of distributors have fallen into trouble with using some other less than legit pub admin services. Well, Too Lost is partnered with BMG. You know it's legit. They offer instant royalty advances. This is something that's very cool. And if you have historical streaming data and you need just a bulk payment up front, they can see how much your music has earned in the past. I'm like, all right, we think we know what you're going to earn in the next 3 years. Here's a check for $100,000 or whatever it will be. And you can just click a button and you get that distributed and into your account immediately. They do lyrics and credits distribution for free. They have a very innovative analytics platform where, yes, you will see real-time analytics for Spotify, Apple Music, but also Pandora, Deezer, SoundCloud, and Peloton. They're the only ones that do Peloton. They also have a service where you can search the internet wherever your music is being used, and it will just show you a chart of everywhere, every TikTok video, everywhere, every YouTube video, everywhere your music is possibly being used. I've never seen this before. That was very cool. They'll register you with SoundExchange, and they have a fraud prevention tool, and they're doing fraud prevention. So if you're worried about your music, you know, getting a bot attack or something like that and getting ripped down, which we've seen is a big issue, they have fraud prevention tools that are better than most other distributors that I have seen. Check out Too Lost. You can just go to toolost.com. Use the promo code Ari's Take for 3 months free and try them out. Let them know what you think. So okay, the LEX thing is interesting. So you found your sound. Now, how did the aesthetic, because LEX is it's a very specific visual aesthetic, and so much of the LEX brand is visual, and you've done so many fashion weeks, and you've teamed up with brands and you know, photographers and designers and all of this. I feel like LEX is as much the sound as it is the aesthetic. It's all kind of, it's the aesthetic is so poignant that I'm curious to know, did that come, were you working on that before you released your first song, or has it evolved through the process?
Yeah, the aesthetic has always been really important to me. I may start rambling, but I'm going to try to explain kind of how that happened. I think throughout school, like, I wasn't bullied in a terrible way, but I was always made fun of a bit. I was always a bit weird. I was never sought after by guys. Like, no one was ever attracted to me, and I never felt attractive. And when I started playing music, I guess, you know, Canadian labels used to kind of pop into shows and stuff, and no one was ever understanding what I was doing. No one, and my music wasn't that great at that time. And I guess I just kind of learned from all those 20 odd years of like rejection and not seeing myself ever wearing like a cute, sexy outfit. Like I felt like I needed to represent myself in a way that was appealing for other reasons. And that's when I started to collect images around the same time I started to produce. And I used to just build, boards of kind of how, even if it wasn't how I wanted to look, it would sometimes just be an obscure photo that would give me like the feeling. And I ended up this feeling, and I ended up calling that feeling X.
Cool.
And I mean, a lot of it's just that Tumblr style imagery, but it really resonated with me. And I found that after all those years of searching and producing and collaborating and collecting and musing, when I arrived to Los Angeles, I had my pitch ready. And I didn't think of it in those terms, but now I do. I had my three songs. They were sounding good. They were interesting. And I had my style. And it was a package that was like ready to... people understood.
Sure.
And that was a really good feeling. And I don't know, moving forward into like all the albums and all the images I've done, it's just something now that I really enjoy. And like you said, I see it almost as important as the music in the project.
Are you the creative director behind most of the art that's put out?
Yeah, always. Yeah.
Always.
I never take the photos myself. I never edit the videos myself, but I pick the photographer, I give them the references, and I sit behind the editor and say, you should cut there, whatever, you know. So
cool.
I'm always, I think it's fair to say I'm the creative director.
What do you have any tips for independent artists who may have this vision, like they've put together the boards, the vision boards, and they have an aesthetic and a style, but they don't have the money to hire the pro photographers, makeup artists, and designers, and can't afford the outfits that they're envisioning? Or what are your like kind of DIY tips to those people? Be like, how do they get this kind of thing together?
Yeah, I mean, it's how I got started, actually. It's not as difficult as one may think, because you find those same ambitious young makeup artists, hairstylists, photographers that don't have their portfolio together, but they have that one photo that really resonates with you, and they're excited to push their art. I always find that maybe it's just because I bring so much excitement and passion to the table when I'm working with visual collaborators, but I've always managed to get it done, because I say like, okay, well, we're not going to shoot in a studio because we can't afford the day rate. Let's shoot outside. I know this showroom really likes me, and they have this designer there, and I'm sure they'll give me one look for one day for a good rate. Or a makeup artist in LA is usually bored as fuck at what they're doing. They're doing the same glamorous thing over and over. So people seek me out now. This is cool. Something that's happened in the last 3 years. Creatives like that, just so they can do something different. So
is that something
it pays to be weird, I guess, as one answer to your question. Well,
and to have a vision and to kind of be passionate about that vision and inspire that passion within others around your vision. Now, were you like seeking out makeup artists from, you're in LA, so like from TV shows or on Instagram, are you noticing like who is tagging who, or like what was the process like to actually find these people?
The way that I started on the like curatorial photo shoot kind of thing was I was at my friend's house in LA looking through her, she had some really cool art magazine, some indie art magazine on her table, and I saw four photos by this photographer that I loved, and I didn't know the photographer, so I'm like looking for her name, and oh, it's Logan White. And I said, I'm gonna find Logan White. Turns out she lived in LA, so that was good. Nice. And I just reached out and said, hey, can we meet? I love your work. I really want to work with you. And so she agreed to work with me, and we, she was the one actually, she because she knew so many more people, she was the one who brought the stylist and the makeup artist to the table. Mm-hmm. And, but sort of like once you meet those ones, then you meet other ones. And nowadays I do so much of the reaching out on Instagram, and you know, once you're like verified on Instagram, you've got a certain number of followers, there is a good chance that you'll get like a response. Sure. So that, yep. that always works in my favor now. But yeah, I don't know. I just kind of wing it. I guess I know what I, another piece of advice I have actually is to let those creatives, let them do their ideas as well. Because they're sick of being told what to do, and they have so many things they want to try out. So I've done more and more of that through my last two records, and it cool. always pays off.
It's almost like a collaboration amongst exactly. artists. And so
exactly.
obviously, like, you know, their vision, you're not going to release anything as Ali X that doesn't fall in line with your aesthetic and your brand.
Yeah.
And if they want to try something out, you know, you could almost like model for them, and they could put it in their portfolio that you necessarily
totally.
Wouldn't release yourself.
Or the beauty of editorial is by definition, it's about pushing boundaries and maybe putting a familiar face in a not familiar look.
Yeah. Your looks are all over the place, and it's yeah. pretty cool to see how versatile it is.
But are they all over the place with the Cape God imagery? No. I keep True. That consistent because it's my album art.
Right. Good point. Yeah.
Yes. But in terms of editorial, yeah, I'm always like, if you got an idea, let's try it. And it's fun.
So that's great. And so when it comes to an album rollout and release like Cape God, what is that process like in terms of from the conception, and when does that aesthetic come into play, and how do you put all of that together in terms of the process from the writing, producing, recording, release strategy?
Oh my God, my head is just spinning thinking about it. it's such a process, especially when you as the artist want to oversee absolutely everything.
Sure.
So, I mean, it always starts with the music for me. Regulars, Fresh Laundry, and Rings a Bell, which are on my record Cape God, were all written on a trip to Stockholm, working with Oscar Gores and James Allen. Mm-hmm. And that was just a trip just to write. I mean, I hadn't even released my EP at that time, Super Sunset. So I was just out there because it was a great opportunity to work with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden we had this new sound. And it didn't sound like anything I'd done, but it felt really right. And I was like, oh, I think this is my next thing. And cool. So, yeah, I kind of knew after those first three songs that it was a body of work.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what I was feeling and what I was envisioning at the time. And by the time I was back in July, that was March, I was back in July of that year, 2018, I knew that it was called Cape God, and I knew that it was sort of a reference to my teenage years, as well as this like non-existent East Coast mythical
right.
landscape.
Of Cape Cod, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I had very limited time with Oscar, cause he's like MXM and very in demand. And, we wrote 1, 2, 3, I think we wrote 7 songs in Sweden. And then the rest of the 12 were demos that I did in LA with my favorite writers and then produced with Oscar.
Mm. And while you were doing this, were you also thinking about any of the rollout or strategy or anything like that? Or was it music first, once the record is done, then you started to think about, okay, now how are we going to put this out?
I think I was thinking about it in loose terms because it's exciting to do that. So sure. I think I knew that I knew that I wanted to drip it out at first. I knew that this was not something my fans were necessarily expecting from me, and I wanted to be able to ease them into it. I knew some of them wouldn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like a fall-winter record, so I wanted the rollout to be fall-winter. What else?
How long? Sorry, go ahead.
One last thing is I knew aesthetically it was going to be a complete departure from like the crazy drag plastic colorful thing that I'd done for Super Sunset. So, I was looking at the photography of Gregory Crutzen while I was writing as inspiration.
Oh, okay, cool.
So that was that was the aesthetic inspiration.
Nice.
Yeah.
And what was the rollout process like? How many singles did you release and how far apart before the full album?
They were about a month apart and we did quite a few. We did Fresh Laundry, Regulars, Rings a Bell, Love Me Wrong, Devil I Know. So five singles before the record came out.
Oh, wow. Great. So it was about 5-6 months before the actual album release that you could kind of prep the whole thing. Yeah.
And I had a monster support tour in the fall as we were dripping them out. So
who was that with?
Formerly Marina and the Diamonds.
Oh, cool. Great.
All through Europe and a bit in the States. And so in my head, I was like, I think it makes sense to be dripping these out. The live show kind of completely changed because the sound of the music changed. So I felt like I had a chance to sort of get a lot of new fans and before the record came out. Looking back, I think I could have just dropped the record and it wouldn't have made that much of a difference, but I don't think there was any harm done either.
Yeah. What are some of the promotional marketing strategies? Because you're an independent artist and it seems you work very closely with your team. What are some of the promotional marketing strategies that you all kind of used for this release that are maybe different now than you would have done 3, 4, 5 years ago, something like that?
We really committed to me touring for the first time, which costs a lot.
Sure.
And it was definitely worth it, in my opinion. I feel really confident on stage. And it was great to have a chance to really settle into my set, go for months, you know? And especially in the European market, I feel like we had a really huge growth there. Cause when I went to sell my first European tour, a lot of it sold out and that was, awesome. That was a really nice surprise. So, I think on the live side, we really committed for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of digital spends, that's one of the things I don't know too much about. It's always just kind of like Instagram, Facebook ads, algorithm, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
One thing that was great about this round was the London office of AWOL got really behind the record. I never had felt AWOL's support this strong before.
Okay.
Felt like they prioritized me in the UK, which was nice.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, on the
Did you
on
have
the
any video
spend.
Strategies that you were you doing lyric videos, music videos, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so we created, we did this whole album art shoot in upstate New York in real nature locations. And while we were there, I think we had 2 shooting days and we got 7 different looks. Mm. For each one, we got also video that we could loop into GIF format. Or just loop into a reverse, which still looks cool. And that's what we use for lyric videos.
Yeah.
And
the lyric videos are really cool and interesting. And it's like the June Gloom one where you're in the desert just kind of spinning. And it, right. But you're not spinning. It's the camera. It's the different.
No, it's me.
Are you actually
frame by
spinning?
Frame.
Oh, yeah. That's what's going on. Okay.
Yeah. It's just a little, it's still photos looped.
Right.
You go 1, 2, 3, and you get about 8 usually. Cool. I've been doing that since my first record. But then I stopped for Super Sunset, and then they're like, "She's spinning again."
Yeah, <It's great. laughs> right. And that's great. The lyric videos, they're quite compelling, which is cool. And there's not a lot. that needs to be done necessarily. It's just like they're done in an artistic way that's like captivating, even though it's just a lyric video and it's not, you know, the full.
And I mean, this sort of relates to one of your previous questions, those spinning GIFs. That's what I put out with Catch as my first thing, and I had a different one for Prime, which came second, and one for my song Bitch as well, which came third. And that was a way of doing something in motion on the cheap, because we didn't have budget for video. But I created something that was interesting and different looking and definitely captivated some people. So I think for people that don't have budgets for video, you know, you can get creative with stuff like that. And you can also make fucking cool videos with like no money. Like sometimes better, like my Bitch video is at the 99 cent store, completely improvised on a tiny little camera attached to a shopping cart. And
amazing.
I think it's better than some of my expensive videos. So, you know, it just, you don't always need a big budget to make something cool.
Right. No, I mean, absolutely. It's all the videos that kind of catch and stick out and people will share and remember are the ones that are creative and sometimes innovative. And it's just doing something a little bit different.
Totally.
So you posted in April about how the Canadian government has supported you and helped you out and through like Radio Star Maker Fund. Can you talk a little bit about how the Canadian government has supported you?
Yes. Bless the Canadian government. They have filled in the gap between my investment deal and, you know, the budget that I'd have if I was a major label artist. It's substantial money. I wouldn't have been able to do these lengthy tours without them. Basically, Canada is, they have these programs, a few different ones. There's the Factor Grants. There's Star Maker Grants is another one. There's one called, I think, the OAC. I don't know. And then there's like a bunch of film grants and like dance grants that I don't even know about. I just know about the music ones. The Canadian, the government is just, I don't know, they're really supportive of artists. And even when I was starting out and I had no resume or experience to my name, I got a little $5,000 grant then to make a demo.
Wow.
And, you know, it's a way for Canadian musicians to always make a living and make records. It's still going to be kind of like a humble living, but I think it makes us all a bit more calm in Canada, even if you're working at a smaller scale, because the government's got your back and you know that you're going to get that amount that you need to make your next record and that amount that you need to pay your band on tour or whatever.
Wow.
In my case, the Star Maker grant they've been so generous with me, I guess because I'm probably, I'm the perfect candidate for it because I'm not a huge artist like Justin Bieber or Drake that doesn't even think about grant money. I don't even know if they know that exists. But I am international and I have an international fan base and I'm super active and ambitious. So the idea of this grant is to get behind an artist like that and get them to the next level. And that's what they've done. I mean, just without their help, like I said, I wouldn't have been able to tour. So.
That's incredible. What does it take to apply and what is that process like to apply for these grants?
It's complicated. You need, I mean, most people are going to hire a grant writer and the grant writer will take a commission.
Okay.
But they'll guarantee that it's done properly. And I mean, I still always need to give information and answer questions for these grant applications, but I didn't even mention on my team, I have a whole Canadian counterpart as well. I have like my UK people, everyone I named is in the US, then I have the UK label, then I have my friends in Canada, they do the grants for me and they also bring me like local gigs and opportunities.
Amazing. And they're okay with you living in LA to receive these grants?
Yes, but if I gave up my citizenship and became a US citizen, I would not be eligible.
Aha. Okay. Yeah. Another reason to keep that Canadian citizenship.
Yeah, exactly. Cool.
That is fantastic and amazing, and how I wish we had something similar to that in the States.
We're very fortunate with that in Canada. Mm-hmm.
That's great. What we have, it's the private equivalent, which doesn't even come close, is Music Cares, run by the Recording Academy. And they're great. They step in like emergency cases. I've heard of situations where an artist needed like hospital bills paid, and they applied for a grant from Music Cares and received it and were able to pay hospital bills. So they're a great organization. During this COVID crisis, they were writing checks to artists, but it was limited to about $1,000 per artist because there was so much demand, and that can help, but it's not even close to what is needed. When you say it's substantial, I'm imagining like tens of thousands of dollars. There's no equivalent to that in the States. There are some like state by state, and even city by city, like Los Angeles is working on, the city council is working on kind of passing some artist grant form a thing, but it's only for like $1,500 maximum, which is nice, but it's like, it's we don't invest as a country in the arts. The arts in the States are the first program to get cut at every school, always the first to get cut, and it's the last to be funded. And so it's,
which is funny though, because all the most, the highest grossing art in the world mostly comes from the United States, and California is the richest state because of the entertainment industry. So it would make sense to...
You'd think there'd be some support. Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess one thing I can say, though, is that in Canada, you don't have the opportunities that you have in the States. So in a way, you have a better shot at actually making a living if you live in Nashville or Los Angeles as a songwriter, in my opinion.
Yes.
Like a good living. And in Canada, I think Canada makes up with its grants for the lack of opportunity and the lack of, like, I hate this phrase, but like star system, like we're all very like humble in Canada, and we don't, we don't like get behind in a big way our artists. So I do have, I think that is why this system is in place. And maybe if in 100 years from now, we're more competitive with the United States, who knows if it'll be the same. I don't know, but I'm grateful, very grateful.
100 years, like maybe 5 years, the way that things are going right now with our country. So
I was like, with global warming and everything that's going on in the States, I was like, do you think that the States will go to war with Canada? My dad's like, they won't go to war with Canada. They'll just take Canada.
Oh God, I hope not. I hope Canada takes us, to be honest. But, well, I have, one final question. Thank you for chatting with me and breaking things down so intimately. And I know that, most interviewers probably don't go into the nuts and bolts like this.
It's fun for me. I'm no longer shrouded in the veil of mystery that I was when I started this. And for, reasons that I chose, it's just, I like the alley that's out there that doesn't know this stuff. I want her to hear this, because I think if I had heard something like this, it would have been helpful. So
absolutely. And the alley out there, all the alleys out there, very much appreciate your candor, and it's it's so illuminating and very helpful. And it's really great hearing the behind the scenes of your story and how it kind of all happened for you, and because it didn't happen, you made it happen. And that's what I think is so important for people to hear that are struggling or getting started or emerging or whatever you want to call it, is that, like, because you said you had the overnight success after 10 years
after
of working your
years.
Ass off.
Yeah.
And still, it's been a journey, and it's been something that you... But it's also great to hear that you are in the driver's seat and that you are the director behind everything. It's not like, you know, a boardroom full of old white men that are just like moving chess pieces around for you and like saying, go here, do this, do that.
No,
it's like you are doing this.
Yeah, and I think that does work for some artists. It wouldn't have worked for me. I've never been like an obvious choice. I've always had to sort of show people why I'm worth it, you know, and that's now deeply ingrained in me. And it's given me, even though I just put myself down, it's also given me like a real confidence when someone really believes that you can't do it something and then you do it, it feels really good. It feels really empowering. And so if someone's listening that isn't the obvious choice and doesn't have labels approaching them just because their song isn't gone viral or because the look isn't right or whatever, you know, it's you can do it. You have to find your own way. You have to find your own path.
Absolutely. So the question I ask everybody who comes on the show is, how do you define what it means to make it in the new music business?
I've been thinking about that a lot lately. And I don't have the answer. I think living comfortably on the art is, I mean, if you're doing that, then you've made it in a way. If you feel like stable, I think you need to feel happy too. Like that's something that I struggle with more. Like it's so stressful.
Yeah.
It definitely doesn't have to do with signing a record deal. I'll say that. It doesn't. I mean, it's starting, you know, it's so funny when I first moved to LA and I started being in all these rooms, these writing rooms. And after all that stuff went down and I was not a signed artist, people would always ask, are you on a major? Are you on a major? And I go, no, I'm not on a major. and people would go, oh, okay, that's cool. And now it's different. People go, are you signed? And I go, no, I'm in a profit share with an investor. And they go, wow, that's cool. Like the attitude has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel really happy with the decision to go that non-traditional path. So I don't think, and I mean, yeah, like these executives, like with all the movements that have happened in the last year, we just see how outdated and how dinosaur like a lot of the people in charge are. And I think the young generation is so smart. I'm excited in a lot of ways to see what happens with all the arts, because things have really shifted.
Definitely. AliEx, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was very insightful and fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Totally. Okay, and we are So it is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out distrokid.com.